With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
This is Jeff T from the Club 520 podcast. When it comes to your feet, eBay's got your back. When you see the blue check mark that says authenticity guaranteed, that means real experts are checking your sneakers. Every stitch, down to the sole. They even smell them because nothing says fresh like the scent of real kicks. So kick back and relax. From the drop to your doorstep, eBay doesn't play games with your sneaker game. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay authenticity guaranteed. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
The Volume.
Charles Darwin.
The Nerds is where it's at.
Welcome everybody back into Nerd Sesh. As always, I'm Carson Brebber and alongside me is Logan Camden and we are back. We took yesterday off. It was finally time for a break and that was a lighter day of action, but we are still going to be covering those games. We're going to be talking about the Wednesday games as well with what we just saw unfold. We also did have the NFL draft today, Logan. We're not going to be talking about that, but a bit of a surprise. Neither you or I selected today. I'd heard some rumblings that maybe I was going one. You were considered maybe more of a day two guy, but I guess neither of us got our number called. So a bit disappointing on that front. But in terms of the basketball, it was fun again. And we're going to start, Logan, with Nuggets Lakers, as we have been. This one, demoralizing for the Lakers fans, I would imagine. Last one, of course, was heartbreaking. This one was more of just like a slow limp to your death. Denver up 3-0 now. This series is all but over. What did you take away from this one?
I mean, the Nuggets are getting whatever they want against LA, a team that I consider to be a great, you know, team and a real playoff contender. And they aren't even really playing up to expectation, in my opinion, man. It's been three real lackadaisical starts for the Nuggets out of the gates. Three really bad first halves, and it hasn't mattered. You know, it hasn't really mattered at all. Like, that's the thing that's been so impressive to me about Denver in this series is this isn't – we're not scraping the surface of 100%. You know, Aaron Gordon mentions it after the game. I thought they asked him a great question. What can you guys do better? A lot. I mean, like, I think the Nuggets can play so much better basketball, and they're still just running the Lakers. Aaron Gordon's the star of the show in this game, you know, keeping them around in the first half, making all kinds of hustle plays. He was for 29 points, 15 boards, and 3 assists on 12 of 18 from the field. So much energy around the rim, and whenever he was, it seems like he was making a play on the ball. He's got 5 offensive boards in this game. Michael Porter Jr., you know, does his job. Like, this is with, you know, Jamal Murray performing below expectation and Nikola Jokic not really having to fully exert himself. That's what's so impressive about all of these wins, and they're just eradicating Lakers leads like that. That's what's been so impressive. And you see a glimpse of what MPJ can bring you on a great day. 20 points, 10 boards, 3 assists on 8 of 16 shooting, just knocking down all kinds of tough buckets that only MPJ seems like he can knock down. I mean, that's been my takeaway, Carson, is the Nuggets at will are getting whatever they want, really regardless. It's been the role players that have stepped up in this series. Like, Jamal has a good game, but not anything outstanding by his standards, and Jokic just does his thing like he does every single game. But that's what stood out to me through three games. The Lakers have played well. Like, you know, there's obviously factors that don't go their way in this game, but by their standards, they're playing good basketball. Anthony Davis has balled out so far in this series, and still they lose their – it's 11 straight now, right? Or is it
11 10? Straight. No, it's 11 now.
Almost three straight series of the Lakers not being able to eke out one single victory, man. And again, the Nuggets are just not even playing close to, I think, 100% of what they're capable of.
This was an easy win for Denver, and it came after a slow start. And I was impressed with the energy that the Lakers came out with. Like, I just thought they might have kind of thrown in the towel after how devastating last game was, and just knowing how LeBron can pick his spots and conserve energy at 39 years old. And obviously it's the playoffs. This is do or die time, but that just felt like the moment was like, all right, clearly you don't have a chance here. But they came out guns a-blazing. They were forcing turnovers, getting stops, running in transition, and Denver still just like sleepwalks to a comfortable win. And clearly the most important takeaway to me from this game is the drastic gap in the supporting casts, because obviously Jokic is the best player on the floor by far. But when you think about the dynamics last year, like, we saw superhuman Jokic. We saw Jokic with that historic game one. He averaged like 28, 15, and 12 super efficiently in that series against AD, who had been having maybe the best defensive run we had seen all century. Jamal Murray gave them a super efficient 32 a night. Like, they were just multiple levels above AD, who had two just complete off nights offensively, wasn't assertive enough, just kind of got embarrassed in that matchup. And LeBron, who was really good in game four, but overall, because his jumper was off, because his foot was off, just wasn't the level of player that he had to be for LA to be competitive in that series. Obviously, Jokic is still head and shoulders above either LeBron or AD at this stage. They have the best duo. But the dramatic difference, the reason that Denver sleepwalks to a game like this, is that their supporting cast is playing at a completely different level. You mentioned Aaron Gordon, Logan. The guy was phenomenal in this game. He is one of the most devastating rim finishing weapons that I've seen in my lifetime. Just the ability to feed that man anywhere in the dunker spot. I've talked about it before, but he can finish from a wider variety of angles than anybody. His body control, his focus is just absolutely spectacular with that otherworldly bounce. And he's just the perfect complementary player, man. A guy who can take on versatile defensive matchups. We've seen him take on the LeBron matchup for a majority of this series. We also saw him change the dynamics of that AD performance last game. That was a collective defensive adjustment and a collective effort, but he was able to challenge AD out of drop coverage, taking away those lob passes. He was able to hold up in single coverage. The guy is just a stud. And then in transition is one of the best players in the league. On the offensive glass has been a monster in this series, Logan. Six offensive boards in game one, three in game two, another five tonight, and particularly in the first half, was just gobbling up his own misses, had that tip in at the end of the first half off a Jokic miss. So he has been phenomenal. MPJ has been so damn good through these first three games. He really kept them alive in the first half of game two when they just desperately needed somebody to step up as a shot maker. I truly believe is one of the handful of most special pure jump shooters that we have seen. When you think about the fact that this guy demanded a near $200 million contract and that he's able to efficiently give you 20 a night and his back was ruined and he doesn't explode off the bounce and he doesn't handle particularly well. And he's grown in a lot of these areas. He's grown as a decision maker, but like basically he can just rise up and shoot over anybody. And he is that ridiculously great a shot maker that he's an incredibly valuable player. And I thought he had another really strong performance. He's had an efficient 19 plus points in every game for Denver in this series. He's run the floor hard in transition. He can just rise up whenever you need it and deliver a big time shot. That's what he does. But it's not just how well those guys have played. It is how horrible the Lakers supporting cast has been, Logan, because I felt more confident in the offensive punch that you got from this group than really anything that we've seen from the Lakers in recent years. This was an offense that was humming down the stretch. They were a top three offense for like roughly the last 30 games of the year, and we were getting great LeBron, but also it was the combination of secondary shot making, D'Lo, unbelievable from deep this year, able to float the offense in stretches. Austin Reeves, another guy, lethal three-point shooter, but just hyper-effective pick-and-roll operator, can get to the line, really good intermediate shot maker. Rui Hachimura, one of my favorites, just grown into a great spot-up shooter, super smart cutter, big physical forward who can mismatch attack. Like, that was part of the reason I was optimistic about the Lakers, again, not beating Denver, of course, but against some of these other teams, maybe pulling an upset, or at least making this series against Denver more interesting than it has been. The difference between what we expect from these guys, what we got from these guys last year, Logan, to what we have seen this year is legitimately shocking. I'm going to read off all the numbers from the Lakers starters outside of LeBron and AD to you, and you are going to be repulsed. Austin Reeves versus Denver in that series last year, gave them 21 a night on 73% true shooting. He was out of his mind as a pure shooter from deep. We saw how lethal his two-man game with LeBron James was. He was just phenomenal. This series, he's under 15 a game on 56% true shooting. And by the way, that number is bogus. I was pissed because he ruined my stat getting those 10 garbage time points in this game. He has done nothing of significance in meaningful stretches of basketball in this series. He's been off as a shot maker, just not close to the level that he was at last year. Rui Hachimura was a revelation against Denver last year because it was like, whoa, the Hotch is going to knock down all his spot-up jumpers. Like, consistently, he had been much more mid-range reliant. We'd never really seen him shoot that volume threes at that efficiency. And then when you take everything else that he does it so well into account, like, he averaged over 15 a night on 62% true shooting in this series last year. This series, Logan, 5 points per game on 42% true shooting. And D'Lo, I can't compare to last year's numbers because he couldn't possibly be worse than last year. But he has been close. Obviously, he had the nuclear first half of game two, but other than that, has been unplayable. Shot them out of game one, did not make a shot in this game. In this regular season, he was an 18-point-per-game guy on 59% true shooting. In this series, 12 points per game on 42% true shooting. And it's legitimately comical. Like, you get the worst version of D'Lo. He sits for a good portion of the second half because of that. And then he comes back in with like 7 minutes to go in the fourth. And his shift is basically taking an early shot clock, pull up three in transition, just like the ultimate, no, D'Lo, really? Like, you're down 10 with 5 minutes to go. You have to be perfect. That's an awful shot. He clangs another three. He's out of the game. The Hotch gets to the line, finally misses both free throws. He was 2 of 4 with 5 points in this game. And Reeves just hasn't been close to the level of last year. So that has been like the major difference. Denver was going to win this series no matter what. But when you look at a game like this where it's like Jokic is coasting, Jamal's not at his best, and they win convincingly, it's because of the dramatic difference in supporting cast. Because, Logan, we've gotten a version of Anthony Davis offensively that you would have begged for if you're a Lakers fan. You would have been super optimistic you would see this guy. You would have been thrilled. He has scored 30-plus points in 3 straight playoff games for the first time in his career. And part of that is great shot-making, like what we saw in the first half of Game 2. If it's those pick-and-pop actions, if it's him working against Jokic in isolation and post-ups, the turnarounds, the floaters, all of it just falling. But he's also weaponized his quickness. He's attacked the glass and been aggressive. He's been more physical than we're used to. Like, the dude has just been delivering offensively. Defensively, I don't think this has been the same dominant AD that we're used to, but just getting that level of offensive production, where last year he had a 14-point game against Denver, he had a 15-point game, and is still be coming up this short. We felt like the Lakers had to make a move at the deadline to address some of the issues on this roster. Glaringly, point of attack defense, and ideally to get a real high-level shot creator alongside LeBron and AD. But I thought offensively, they were going to be really good. I thought the aggregate shot making and skill from these other starters was going to be enough. I was worried about the defense, and it just hasn't. They've been so bad.
It's been embarrassingly bad. And I wonder if D'Angelo Russell is playing his way out of Los Angeles for the second time, man. Like, I don't know how he can return.
Hate him, dude.
Yeah. I mean, this is two abysmal playoff series back to back. And yeah, in this one, no points, 0 of 7 shooting. He's 33% from the field, 31% from deep. Reeves stat pads tonight somehow to 22 to make it look, like not as bad a game. And the ripple effects, what I think is so, so much bigger than these guys just not shooting poorly is the fact that because Denver doesn't have to respect these guys as over-the-top and perimeter shot makers, they could just help so much more. You know, Anthony Davis and LeBron aren't nearly as effective in the fourth quarter, but that's also because, the Denver's defense can divert so much attention to Davis and LeBron in the paint every time because it's like, okay, you guys haven't hit anything all game. We're not going to respect you. Like, go ahead, put up all those shots. And it's a bad shooting night for both teams. The Lakers shoot 5 of 27 from deep. Denver shoots 5 of 28. This is a game, frankly, you have to capitalize on. Denver's not going to shoot this poorly maybe the rest of the playoffs. Like, this is, I know they had 2 finals games last year where I believe they make less and still win, which is, just ridiculous. It's what Denver
Logan
does.
Also, Think about how poorly Denver shot in the first half of game one. They were 6 of 26 from three. In the first half of game two, they were 6 of 23 from three. You have gotten three consecutive bad shooting games from Denver. You have gotten three consecutive slow starts and a lethargic effort at the beginning from Denver, and you're still down 3-0. That tells you how big the gap here is.
Three great Anthony Davis games. You've got
three great offensive AD games.
You couldn't have asked for a dream scenario. If you told me that those two things would swing in the Lakers' favor, I'd say, all right, well, it's 2-1 or it's 1-2 right now. And the Lakers are in this series. And that's where I'm really disappointed with this team from top to bottom, is especially the effort category. It did feel like in the second half, it's a mental thing. So many people talk about, and I hate to do this to you, Carson, but they're the first example that popped up in my brain. The Buffalo Bills lost four straight Super Bowls in the 90s, right?
Uncalled for.
And they controlled the last Super Bowl that they played against Dallas. They were up going into the second half. It looked like this is finally going to be it. But there was this cloud looming over Buffalo, and they completely collapsed in the second half because it's like, oh, man, it's just going to happen again, right? And that's how I feel like the Lakers are at this point against Denver. They've gotten beaten so many times in this same way and same fashion. It's like, yeah, we're up at the half, but the second Denver started leading the resistance, the Lakers just crumbled. And when Denver is shooting this poorly, and when Anthony Davis is playing this well, you have to win all the effort categories and do all the little things. And the Lakers just haven't. In this game, again, you know, big credit to Aaron Gordon, big credit to MPJ for doing their thing. Denver wins the rebounding battle in this game, 55-45. They win the offensive rebounding battle, 14-8. Like, with all these other factors, it's like I really do think effort could be the difference too. Not just shot making. I mean, at least make it closer. And the Lakers have kind of thrown in the towel, it's felt like, every second half, where they're just they crumble. And this one really felt like once Denver started leading the charge back, it was like the Lakers were cooked. I think this series is done. I think Denver finishes them off right, you know, next game, dude. I don't know what the Lakers do from here on out, man.
I don't think LA's thrown in the towel. This game, LeBron felt disengaged down the stretch. Last game, he was not, right? He was being aggressive throughout that entire second half. Denver just started defending him significantly better. The switch to put AG on AD and to put Jokic on Rui really shut down that LeBron AD two-man game, that pick and roll that had been so lethal, and KCP held up well against LeBron, and even Murray and Christian Brown on switches. Like, LeBron kept coming in that game, and he still got some good shots. I think he had like 11 points in the fourth quarter, but it wasn't ultimately enough. This game, LeBron just coasts to 26-6-9. Like, LeBron's been able to do that for the last 20 years, man. This was not a super impactful LeBron game, but I don't view that at all as like a condemnation of where LeBron is at, because LeBron post All-Star game was ridiculous, bro. He was ridiculously good offensively. I've recited these numbers before, but better than 27 points and 9 assists per game on 67% true shooting. Career best shooting from deep, still lethal mismatch attacker, basketball genius, passer. But like, there's that moment late in this game where there's 5 minutes and change left on the clock. He literally just dribbles the ball off his foot, and it doesn't look like he cares whatsoever. Like, 39-year-old LeBron, I just don't think is wired to every single game, every single half go, all right, AD, you and I have to do everything. And that's where it's just such a letdown from the Lakers supporting cast. You didn't get the version of LeBron that you needed to win a game like this. But ironically, like, maybe you would have if the guys around him were playing better. And that's not to make an excuse for LeBron. That's just to say, I still think LeBron is playing basketball at an unbelievably high level when he is engaged, when he is dialed in, when he is aggressive. And it really was ultimately just a roster that was completely outclassed. And of course, to be clear again, the Nuggets duo is better. Jokic is way better. Fourth quarter of game two, those guys were way better. But like, throughout this series, goodness, there has been a gap in the supporting casts.
I mean, the Nuggets role players are just better. I mean, there's a huge gap. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that if the Lakers supporting cast had been playing better, maybe LeBron kicks into gear. You know, like I said, man, I think it's this team. I think they're all mentally done. You know, I think they're all mentally finished. And the thing with LeBron too, he's the leader of this team, man. You cut the head off the snake, snake's done. You kill the queen bee, man, the hive's done. Like, once your leader throws it in, man, the rest of the team is going to fall. You need that guy to push forward. And I don't really look at the Lakers any differently, man. I do look at a couple of these players. Like, I wonder if it's time to have a referendum on, like, just D'Angelo Russell and how he can impact the game during the playoffs. And it's not even the fact that, you know, the way D'Angelo Russell gets buckets, his stat line is going to vary game to game because it's a lot dependent on jump shots. So there's going to be variance game to game. And you can expect him to sometimes have great games shooting off the dribble and off the catch, and sometimes he'll have bad ones. Like, again, you said it. Look at first half of game two. Mm-hmm. The issue with guys like D'Lo is how limited in other facets of the game that they can really make an impact. Can he defend on the perimeter? Is he going to go crash the glass hard and make an impact there? Is he going to play make well as for his teammates? And I think you made a great point at a crucial point in this basketball game when you are ice freaking cold, you haven't scored a point, you haven't made a shot. Like you said, dude, you got to play perfect. You have to erase a double-digit deficit in 5 minutes. It's time to make great decisions every time the floor and to generate high-quality shots. And he pulls a Denzel Valentine and says, yeah, let me pull up in transition.
He pulls a D'Lo, bro. We can just call that a D'Lo. That's how he's wired.
And it's just the reality of who he is as a basketball player, man. And when his shot is off, he is basically a zero in terms of value, man. He doesn't bring anything else, man. And you need guys like that. They're going to impact the game beyond scoring, man. Look at the Knicks role players. Look at the Lakers role players. D'Lo's the guy that's going to have to wear the biggest biggest responsibility for this series, man. I think it was a big prove-it year for him. This is a career year for him from the field, from behind the arc. And I was more confident in him than I ever have been in his entire career. I took up for D'Lo. You know, I thought it was going to be a different playoff run. And I have been steadily disappointed.
Yeah, of course it's disappointing. I've never been a big D'Lo guy, or at least I haven't for years. I actually really love D'Lo like that Nets year. But once you realize what he looks like in serious basketball context, there's always that element of taking the offense out of rhythm, inability to pressure the rim. So it's always the same tough shot-making diet. But for him to be this bad is just really embarrassing. You talk about what's next for the Lakers. The vision is you have a bunch of these mid-sized contracts that should be movable. D'Lo making $18 million, Rui making $17 million, Austin Reeves making $13 million. Even like Vando, Gabe Vincent, obviously the discussion is going to be what star can they go in and get? And I think there's multiple answers. Like, you would ideally want to address point of attack defense. I could also see a case for somebody who can carry more of an offensive load during the regular season. But to me, it is the former. It doesn't have to be a star. You just need better role players, like dudes who are going to embrace the defensive end of the floor, because the offense was clearly lacking, but also they were never going to have answers for Denver. They never had somebody at the point of attack who could really make Jamal uncomfortable in this series. There's no answer for Jokic. AD, you would think, is as good of an answer as you could throw at him, but good God, man. I mean, Jokic destroyed AD last year, but I feel like there were at least more possessions where AD had wins, where he disrupted him with his length. And again, Jokic convincingly won out in the end, but like this one, it's just a couple of situations where it's a pass and cut and he easily gets by him and it's an easy floater. Like, there's just not the resistance even from AD. We know how easily Jokic barbecued him in single coverage in game two. And hey, man, that's the best offensive player ever. Like, you're not going to have answers for him. But overall, like, AD has not been as impactful as a rim protector. He hasn't been as impactful as a deterrent in this series as we expect from him. So although the offense has been really, really good, I don't think this is like the best possible version of AD, because normally you expect more from him defensively. But ultimately, this is just a Denver team that is so damn good, dude. To be able to sleepwalk like this, they're shooting 27% from deep in this series. A lot of the key stretches have been on the back of their defense. And I do think this is a really, really solid defense. Like, again, you got sort of apathetic Jokic in the first half of game two and through a lot of this game, and they're still just picking you apart. One last thing I want to touch on for Denver. I really, really liked some minutes that we got from a specific unit at the start of the fourth quarter. And it was reminiscent of what the Nuggets did with their bench last year, where they just didn't play like a backup five because they don't have a playable backup five. But I really liked what we saw from that Murray, Brown, Peyton Watson, MPJ, Aaron Gordon unit. I thought They were playing fast. There's just a lot of athleticism out there with those dudes. There's a lot of defensive versatility, right? They can switch basically everything there. There's enough shot making. Brown and Watson will be hot and cold, but they're solid. And then Murray and MPJ are obviously great. We saw 9 DeAndre Jordan minutes in game one. I don't really expect to see DeAndre Jordan again, but this is similar to what the Nuggets did in game two as well with their bench units. But I really like that. They went +3. They won the non-Jokic minutes, and I thought that was a valuable little stretch of basketball. But the Nuggets aren't even playing well, man, and they're still doing this to the Lakers. So that series is over.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey guys, this is Matt Jones, Drew Franklin from the Fade This podcast. We got a great episode coming up, picks in all the sports, football, basketball, we do them all, but here's a preview of this week's episode. Do you think it's more embarrassing to dye your hair or to have hair plugs?
I don't think either are embarrassing if you're not trying to conceal it and act like you didn't.
Okay, so you think if you just come out and go, I got hair plugs...
Yeah, like check out these hair. I mean, don't just walk around, hey, tapping, hey, stranger, I don't want you thinking this is natural. You know, but I mean,
do you have to do that with everyone you meet?
Some people try to act like they, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I mean, like John Cena got him. You know, when John Cena came back to wrestling, he had a bald spot, and now he doesn't. Mm-hmm. You think he should be required in all interviews to say, look, by the way, I covered up my bald spot?
Yeah, I guess it's weird. I mean, you don't wear a sign or like put a sign in your yard, but.
All right, so what about toupees?
Those are the most obvious.
But let's say you're like Bill Self and you can get it to where it looks good.
His is magical. I don't even know if his is a toupee.
It is.
I think he went into the future and had a procedure we haven't even discovered yet.
And this episode was brought to you in partnership with DraftKings. To hear more, listen and subscribe to Fade This on iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
Talk about the other series that... has been really exciting that we saw game three of today. This one, the team that was down 2-0 picks up a win, that being the Philadelphia 76ers. By the way, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Balls Deep for sending us a couple of bucks, a little bit of Skrilla. Shout out to you, man. What? I'm just saying the guy's name. So the Sixers pick up a win. They go home. They defend their home court. What did you take away from this one, Logan?
I was really impressed, super impressed with Joel Embiid. I mean, this is a must-win scenario where – your back's against the wall, man. There's no choice but to deliver. You know, this is your season. And I thought it was a statement game for Philadelphia and Embiid both. And I talked about it in our last episode. There's a drastic offensive skill gap between these two teams, and that just won out today. Like, if Embiid and Maxey play like this, 76ers should run the series. It's a playoff career high for Embiid, 50 points, 8 boards, 4 assists, 13 of 19 from the field, 5 of 7 from behind the arc. He shoots 21 free throws in this one, knocks down 19 of them. The thing that was so remarkable to me about this game from Embiid, Carson, is the fact that Joel Embiid is clearly not at 100% or close. Like, if I had to put a number on it, I would guess that this is Joel Embiid at like 70 to 80%. You know, he starts, and this is back to the regular season too, Joel Embiid's a guy that starts most of his actions from the triple threat. You know what I mean? He's going to face up to the basket and... he's going to pump. He's going to take his time. And if you give him that gap, he's just going to settle for the jump shot. Embiid has consistently, since his return, not weaponized getting downhill, even if his jumper's, you know, falling, even if he can. And I think that's because, you know, he's not at full strength. Like, I just don't think he can exert his body physically like that. So you're getting a guy who, yeah, scored 50 points at basically 75%. I don't know if you saw the update, Carson, during the game. The Lakers-Nuggets game, we get a report that, you know, Embiid went over, they gave, you know, like a diagnosis for potentially him having Bell's palsy. Like he's dealing with that. You see the,
I know.
His eye in game two, you see.
My friend Ethan actually diagnosed him several days ago correctly with Bell's palsy.
Well, it was strange, you know, cause you see, you notice all these things during the game and it was strange. And so all this is going on and he just casually drops a 50 piece with his back against the wall. Like, that was my big takeaway, man, is if we ever do get Joel Embiid at 100%, good God, man, what does that look like? Is he just going to come out here and drop a 70 burger, an 80 burger? He dropped 50 at 75%. Like, I don't know, man. He looked like a big Carmelo Anthony in this game, man. Knocking down every mid-range J, all out of the triple threat. He's banging big threes. He had a couple big ones in Hartenstein's mouth. Like, he just took over. This is the game that we have been waiting for Joel Embiid, and I didn't know if we were going to get it the rest of the series considering his struggles, how well New York matches up with him physically, and then, you know, obviously how he is nowhere close to 100%, man. What a big game from Embiid. And on with that, what a series this has been from Tyrese Maxey too, man. Like, the offensive gap is just massive. Maxey in the series, Carson, your boy, putting up 31-5-7 on 51% from the field and 39% from deep. And this one, 25-4-7. You know, it's just really encouraging from Philadelphia that we saw them fight like this. And the key stretch was in that third quarter. Philadelphia goes 9-12 from behind the arc. New York goes 2-7. They outscore New York 43-27 in the third quarter. Big shout out to Campaign.
Yeah, man. Playoff Cam.
I was literally laughing on my couch when I saw Campaign get subbed in. I thought this would be a comical disaster. Goes 3-4, hits big threes. He's got really active hands. Hits a step back in this one. Genuinely, with how grimy the Knicks and how it can grind to a standstill sometimes with them, where it's, you know, Brunson taking a tough midi. You know, the Knicks can really struggle. Campaign just lights it up, man. That's a really big stretch from them. And then I want to give a big shout-out to another Sixer, Kelly Oubre, too, dude. 15 points, 7 boards, 3 assists in this one. Hits a big 3 in the third quarter, too. But just great defense, energy, and effort all game long. 3 offensive boards in this one, 2 steals. So it's the offensive skill gap. I also think it's the Sixers doing a great job of getting the Knicks bigs in foul trouble. Anytime you can get Hartenstein and Robinson off the floor and get a Chihuahua minutes, or getting those guys consciously thinking, like, can I foul? You know, getting them to play differently because of the scenario. It's just a win for Philadelphia. But the offensive skill gap won out in this game. I thought it was a great Jalen Brunson game. But the Sixers, their offense wins out. But a lot more energy, a lot more defensive effort, and just an impressive prove-it game for Philadelphia. 2-0, must-win fashion. You need to stand and deliver. And Joel Embiid, Maxey, and the Sixers did that as a whole, man. They needed this one bad, and I'm glad they got it done.
They threw their best punch in this one, and I just don't think the Knicks can quite match the Sixers' best punch. I picked New York to win this series, but there's just a ceiling when Embiid has everything going. And Maxey, this wasn't his best game. This was honestly his weakest game of the series, but he's been so consistently great. Like, Philly had still had, honestly, the two best players on the floor through the first two games because of how off Brunson had been. But Embiid hadn't been convincing in those performances. And clearly he was hampered by the injury and he was super jump shot reliant. And they weren't falling like they were in this one. Like, my goodness, dude, that has been the biggest cause for Embiid's playoff downfall. We talk about all the factors: health, significant over the years; playmaking, significant over the years; him breaking down in those playoff environments; his reliance on getting to the line, not translating. Certainly wasn't a problem in this one, but generally you don't get as favorable a whistle. Your free throw rate goes down. You flail. That turns into a turnover where maybe it's free throws in the regular season. But the single biggest thing has been that last year, Embiid went from this stellar jump shooter generating 0.97 points per jump shot in the regular season to 0.59, Logan. That is like a 35-40% drop-off in your efficiency as a jump shooter, right? And then the year before that, he went from 0.94 points per jump shot to 0.7 in the playoffs. He's been under 28% from three in his playoff career. Like, consistently, his jumper has just failed him. And in this one, it was the foundation of everything. It was unbelievable. Facing up against Mitchell Robinson, stepping back, nailing a jumper over a double team multiple times in this game, nailing these jump shots through contact, nailing these jump shots even when he's like clearly trying to get a foul call and he doesn't, and he still makes them anyways. And then the four triples in the third quarter was just absurd. Like, when Joel Embiid is that level of jump shooter, he's unguardable. And that's the Joel Embiid that we see so often in the regular season. It's just like rhythm dribble pull up right in your face, right? Just jab step, face up jumper right in your face. You can't do anything about it. Knocking down his spot up threes and his pick and pop threes. And that was the version that the Knicks got. And ultimately, they couldn't do anything with that version of Joel Embiid because nobody can. We haven't seen that. And for him to do it, as you said, under these circumstances, with the knee injury still being a factor, with Bell's palsy on top of that, like, that is really extra remarkable. You can't stop that shot making if you're the Knicks. What you can do, though, or what you have to do a better job of at least, is keep him off the line, because it's just egregious in this game. And Embiid is getting a favorable whistle. I didn't expect him to get this whistle in the playoffs because historically he hasn't, but he has been eating up free throws. He goes to the line for 21 free throws. Six of those come off intentional fouls, but still he was living at the line alongside that incredible jump shooting in this game. We've seen it in consecutive games now where Hartenstein gets up in his airspace. Last time he got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, this time he just infringes on the landing space. Three free throws for Joel Embiid in this one. Like, you just can't afford to give him those opportunities. And it seems like there's a pretty strong directive among the Knicks to specifically get up in his airspace. I presume because he doesn't trust his knee right now and he's not threatening you as a driver as much. And like I said, you see some spots in this game where he thinks, okay, this guy's up in my airspace, I'm going to flail. And he doesn't get the call. He makes the jumper anyways. So I don't know that we can say that it's been like a clear negative, because they are making those shots a little bit harder. But you got to think about the risk-reward factor here. And is it making those shots difficult by a wide enough margin to offset the fact that at some point in this game, he's going to get a call and that's just literally free points? I don't know, man. With the whistle he's getting, I'd be concerned. And you have to like play it perfectly if you're going to do that. You have to stay vertical, keep your hands totally clean, hands where I can see them. It's just a little bit tricky. It's a fine line that they're walking. And then, like, you just hardly see an Embiid drive without a whistle. And it's tough to say, like, how great every single one of these calls is. There's definitely contact on all of these, and they just have to do a better job of not fouling in those situations. Like, I get these physically overwhelming, but you're better off sending extra bodies his way. You're better off aggressively helping and trying to defend him cleanly than you are just sending an 87% free throw shooter to the line over and over and over again. And he's baiting for these calls. He's getting these calls. He was remarkable as a shot maker on top of it. And that's just peak Joel Embiid when he has all those things going at once. Maxey, though, as well, dude, just reliably balling out, man. Like, this is special consistency that we've seen from him through three games. So hard to keep out of the paint. Just one of the quickest downhill guards. And then that floater is as lethal as anybody's. Always gets out in transition. One of the fastest full court guards. And the pull-up shooting has mostly been pretty good in this series, but he's doing this drawing tough perimeter matchups, man. The guy is having OG and Deuce McBride thrown at him, and he is still creating separation. He is still delivering this big time shot making. He's been super impressive. And then I think you hit on the last key as well. Philly's supporting cast offensively had really under delivered. Tobias Harris has been super disappointing in this series. Didn't step up in this game, but Oubre did. He was aggressive from the jump, weaponized his athleticism, knocked down some jumpers, campaign, did have that valuable stretch. Like, they've just needed somebody to step up as the third guy, because in game two, they really had nobody. And then when you have that improved production from the supporting cast on top of this version of Embiid, the Sixers are really, really tough to beat when they have that all going. It is remarkable to think, Logan, that they're paying Kelly Oubre $3 million and they're paying Tobias Harris $40 million. Kelly Oubre, who is harassing Jalen Brunson defensively, doing an unbelievable job there, and was clearly the better offensive player in this game. Tobias Harris, who is out there
missing mid-range jumpers. Yes, that is what Tobias Harris is out there doing. It is remarkable.
Fun, at least.
It's an insane value contract. And Philly's New York is just not going to have, you're right, New York doesn't have the requisite offensive punch if these guys are going to play like that. Like, Jalen Brunson goes for 39 and 13 assists in this game, and they lose. That is the silver lining, I think, for New York in this series. Because of their grit, because of how hard they play and how hard they fight and how much and how consistently they hunt quality offensive shots, The Knicks are going to be in every single game against Philly going into the fourth quarter. That I am confident enough. You know, in terms of how they make life hard on Philadelphia, how bad they crash the glass. Like, New York is going to be in these games. What is going to win New York these games is shutting them down in the fourth quarter. It is, and I think you hit on a big thing with Embiid. It is not clanging and banging with him in the paint, because I think that's a losing situation. I thought their best success defensively was when they sent Dante DiVincenzo or somebody on help side on the baseline and doubled him right there. Like, you know, he knocked a couple balls loose. Like, you're either forcing it out of his hands or he's taking a jump shot with two people in his face. And honestly, Carson, I don't know if this is worth it. With his inconsistent jump shooting, tonight this wouldn't have worked, obviously, because he was lights out. I mean, this is an elite Embiid jump shooting game. Do you run drop on him the whole time? And what I mean by that is give him, you know, 6 inches. Give him a foot off the ball. And if he doesn't want to initiate that contact, I mean, have him settle for the jumper. I just don't want to give him, you know, 10 to 20 free throws a night, because he's going to knock those down. He's going to kill you like that. That's what he wants to do. I wonder if it's just better all game, sending those timely doubles and consciously trying to make him settle for that jump shot. I mean, when he's on, he's going to kill you regardless. But I wonder if that's the smartest way to defend him. But that's the crucial stretch for me, man. I think is how cold you can get Embiid and Maxey in the fourth quarter, man. That's got to be the game plan for New York.
He is so jump shot reliant right now, though, that I wouldn't want to play off him. Like, I wouldn't want to bait him into those looks, because he's taking those looks no matter what, and you might as well get the best contest. But there is the fine line from, like, all right, we are deliberately saying, okay, Joel, let's see how much we can get in your airspace without getting a foul call, and just being aware that he's not the same threat maybe off the bounce as he normally is, and making sure to get an active contest on all those jumpers, because he is relying on them. On the flip side of this, Logan, it's obviously the first loss of the series for the Knicks. But I also think there's some encouraging stuff in here. The biggest thing being that Jalen Brunson got going with a big, big game. 39 and 13 in this one. And my favorite thing was not just that the shot making was improved, that he had 39 points. I loved how much he was looking to facilitate, because that was my biggest takeaway from game two. The best stretch of offense that he got was when he was hitting those pocket passes to Isaiah Hartenstein, when he was drawing a second defender and then finding him, letting him show that incredible touch finishing in the paint, just because the physical toll on Brunson when he has to shoot 30 times a night is so significant. He still takes 27 shots in this game, and those shots are so difficult, and there's so much length on this Philly defense. Like, there are just ways to amplify your impact, to make your teammates have significantly better offensive performances without having to bear that load as the guy taking the shot every time down the floor. And Brunson is a shoot first player, but in this game, I thought he did a great job of trading some of those tough twos that he's been relying on for kickouts to open 3-point shooters, right? You dig, he was willing to make that pass to whoever it was. He was, again, finding Hartenstein off the roll and on those dump offs, and Hartenstein's touch is unreal, period, but it's been especially unreal in this series. They trapped Brunson once. I thought he did a great job of getting that ball out. Hartenstein got a dunk versus a 4-on-3. So the passing was really, really a positive. But also, he was getting better shots. His shot making was just off in the first couple games, but he was taking lots of tough jumpers over bigger, longer players in traffic. This game, I thought he did a better job of driving hard, especially when Embiid was off the floor. If B-ball Paul was at the five, Brunson was going to make sure that he got into that paint, which was a good thing. And even on Embiid, he's not going to challenge him at the rim, but getting to those 7-foot floaters instead of those like 15-foot mid-range pull-ups makes a difference. And getting quickly and decisively downhill with the defender trailing is a good thing, because when he's tried to trap those guys on his back, like, they're so long that the rear view contests have affected him some. So it was a decisive, smart game from Brunson. 1 point, he had Batum in single coverage, just dusted him off the bounce, got a clean layup. Embiid wasn't totally dialed in help. He finally got a couple open threes, like legit open threes, which has been so hard for him in transition, spotting up. Like, Philly's been so attached to him off ball that it was nice to just see him get a couple of nice, easy looks to build a rhythm. He got to the line more. He did make more threes. So he was just generating more high-value offense. I love how Brunson just carves his way to wherever he wants to get around the mid-range and on the outside of the paint. Like, that's generally very reliable offense. But also, you got to get some of the easy stuff. And in the first two games, he didn't get any of the easy stuff. In this game, he did get some of the easy stuff, and I think that that was valuable to him having an improved game. Still had a couple costly turnovers late in this one, particularly you just see how well Kelly Oubre is defending him, hounding him, and he picks up his dribble without a plan and just kind of throws the ball away. And then he had that miscommunication with DiVincenzo. So wasn't the strongest close. But if I'm a Knicks fan, I'm just happy to see Brunson get it going, because the Sixers had that man in jail and they defended him better than anybody else in the regular season. And they have great personnel, a bunch of dudes to throw at him. And he's had to carry such a load that it's like, just seeing them put up an offensive performance like this, even in a loss, is encouraging, because for your ceiling long-term, like, you can't keep winning games just on heart, just on offensive rebounding, just from your role players making clutch plays. Like, at some point, your guy has to be the guy. And he was, for the most part, in this game.
Jalen Brunson is, like, the perfect point guard, man. I just love him so much. That he's so valuable to have. Like, he... Brunson rarely makes a bad decision. He is such a good game manager and decision maker, man. And the way he gets into the lane is invaluable, because it just sets up the entire offense, man. If he is getting to that floater range shot, if he is taking a tough turnaround, or if he's kicking it back out and even getting like a hockey assist where the Knicks swing it back out, and all of the guys around Brunson, save the big man, if it's Hartenstein or Robinson, compliment him in the sense that all of them are capable catch-and-shooters. All of them can attack a closeout and hit a mid-range jumper. Like in this one, you know, Hart gets into the teeth of the defense, hits a floater. OG Anunoby gets in there, hits a midi. Like, these are some of the most valuable shots that you can hit in the playoffs, because, you know, I know that we all focus on all shots at the rim or three-pointers, right? They're the most valuable shot in basketball. In playoff basketball, you're going to need to knock down some of these shots, and the Knicks supporting cast around Brunson is just so capable of doing all of it. And he's the one that gets it started. Like, he's one of my favorite players, man. He's one of the most impactful 6'2" players in like basketball history, man. Like, there's just, it's rare that you see a small guard like this impact the game in such a major way. And he's such an elite shot maker, man. He just has elite touch. Like, Jalen Brunson just generates so many high quality looks for himself and for his teammates every single game, man. He's just reliable. I love Jalen Brunson so much. He still bears such a responsibility. Like, I think it speaks volumes that he does all this and they still do lose. And Josh Hart has another big game. He's been awesome in this series. Like,
yeah, their offense was good. It was just Embiid giving you 50, man. You're not going to win a game when Embiid gives you 50.
Literally. I don't want this to go under the radar because Embiid had 50 points, man. This was an elite Brunson game, and he is so consistent, dude. Brunson is one of the premier point guards in this league, man. And I do think the supporting cast can do a little more. Hartenstein and Robinson not getting in foul trouble, you know, is going to be huge, I think, in later games. I think DiVincenzo can do more offensively. Josh Hart has another stellar game. Carson, this dude, in this series, this is remarkable. I cannot believe this is a real Josh Hart stat line. 21 points, 11 rebounds, and 4 assists on 52%. From behind the arc, man.
Ridiculous.
In this game, 15-7-3, hustle plays, Hart plays, everything. Anunoby has some of his moments. He playmakes for Hart for a three. He has really big, two back-to-back clutch threes in this game. There was another one where I think Oubre was on him, and he just explodes right past him for an easy dunk. I mean, that to me is going to be a big key, Carson, is how the rest of the Knicks' offensive pieces can step up. Can Anunoby give me 20? You know, can Hartenstein, because Hartenstein had another good game, can he consistently keep giving me 15? Can I get more from Deuce? Again, they can slow down Philly a hell of a lot, but it's going to be on the supporting cast for the Knicks to keep producing, man. And obviously, they're going to have to play Embiid better, which was the key of this game. But they are going to need a little more firepower from the rest of this Knicks bench.
They were pretty good in this one, though, man. I mean, the spot-up shooting has been excellent. Like, this is a reality with the Knicks team, dude. You can't expect somebody else to, like, be a second legit creator. They're shot makers when they're on. Josh Hart normally is not a shot maker. In this series, he's decided to be. That's fantastic for the Knicks. But, like, DiVincenzo had a couple nice cuts in this game. He's going to knock down a hell of a lot of threes. Normally, this game, he didn't. OG, I thought, took on a little bit more of that responsibility as a guy to get himself a shot, and then he also knocked down a couple of big spot-up threes. Like, the Knicks' offense, I thought, was good in this game. I really don't have any issues there. Hartenstein, it's so valuable to have a guy you can dump it off to, and he doesn't have to directly challenge Embiid as a rim protector.
Dude,
he
that little
pops it right over him.
That little lefty floater today, man, where he goes to the ground, it's a disgusting shot.
Whose floater would you take? I put out this poll on Twitter today, him or Rashawn Holmes?
Rashawn's
floater discourse at its best.
Rashawn's got a little more of that guard kind of floater where he like gets into it. Hartenstein's is more like a stop and just like
they're both like push shots. I mean, yeah. Hartenstein, you're right. There's a lot more range on Rashawn's. Rashawn could hit that thing from 15,
like the
16
elbow
feet out.
Yeah.
Hartenstein is consistently, you know, within 10 feet so.
I'm gonna say Hartenstein just because he's so much bigger than Holmes. Like it's just an it's an unblockable shot, really, for him, like even against other bigs.
I think he's very willing to deploy it around the basket at a higher volume, but I think Rashawn was shooting like 60-something percent, and again, from further out. I'm probably taking Rashawn, but I think once you get into that interior area, like they're very similar, it's just the range. Like Rashawn, it was effectively a mid-range jumper for him, just ridiculous. There's floater discourse for you folks. Okay, last thing I think we need to touch on from this game, Logan, Joel Embiid grabbing Mitchell Robinson's legs. A lot of people thought he should have been ejected. What did you think? Did you think that was a dirty play?
I didn't think he should have been ejected, no. This game was also just chippy from the jump, man. It was – I was glad it got – like we calmed down because in the first quarter I was kind of worried that we were going to have a fight between everybody. But that wasn't like the only like – you know, he knees Robinson in the nuts in one play in this one. It's just classic. Physical, man. It's grimy. These are two teams that play in the same division. Philly and New York hate each other. I've liked how the refs have whistled this series and given these guys a little more leeway to play physical. But in that play specifically, nah, I wouldn't have ejected Embiid. I didn't think it was particularly dirty.
Really? You didn't think it was particularly dirty? That's bad, dude. You can't grab somebody's legs when you're on the floor.
You would have bounced him from the game.
I definitely would call that a dirty play. I would call that quite a dirty play. It's on the line. I think it is probably ejection worthy.
What do you think?
Opinion. It's just dangerous. It's a very dangerous play.
What do you think about Embiid's temperament in general, man, and kind of like how he conducts himself?
He's a villain. And I think he likes being a villain. And you know what? It's good for the Knicks to play a villain, especially when that guy's in Madison Square Garden. By the way, there were so many Knicks fans in Philly
tonight.
Yeah,
dude.
My goodness.
Well, I mean, the train runs. I mean, that's an easy.
I know, but I mean, Sixers season ticket holders are selling their tickets. That's crazy to me. Come on, guys.
That's fair. I don't know. I mean, I figured it was – I kind of took it – I kind of expected New York to kind of – like not like have an advantage in Philly because Philly fans are rabid and – I think they were the second team in overall attendance this season. The Knicks were third. Philly was two. Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. Knicks fans are rabid, though. I kind of expected them to roll deep in this series.
Yeah, I am generally super anti-ejection. I'm super anti-tech. You know my take. Basically, if it doesn't get physical, don't give a tech, especially in a playoff environment. I don't care what that guy said. I don't care if he said he was going to do something inappropriate to your mother. Like, it's basketball. It's highly competitive. Let the men play. But when you start potentially injuring other players, that's bad territory. And I thought that was a really, really clear, dirty play from Embiid. But hell of a performance from him overall. Good win from Philly. We are going to take a quick break here, guys, get you some words from DraftKings. Then we're going to be back talking about the last game of today, and then also the stuff that we didn't get to cover yesterday. The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more.
Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code NERDS. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code NERDS only on DraftKings. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Cavs magic, Logan. We saw a reversal today. The Orlando Magic could not put the ball in the bucket in the first two games. Today, it was the Cavs who couldn't put the ball in the bucket. Not that either of them have been doing so easily, but Orlando got a little bit of offensive juice going in this one, and they win in a blowout. What did you take away from them taking this one, now trailing just 2-1 to Cleveland?
The young guys stepped up in a big way in this game, man. I talked about how I thought Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner needed to kind of impose themselves a little more, and Paolo had been willing. His shot hadn't been falling. I was really impressed that, like, Franz Wagner took over a lot more of the playmaking responsibilities in this game. I think he kind of has to be their de facto play starter and generator and just kind of initiator of the offense, and I thought he did a phenomenal job in this game of getting downhill, collapsing the defense, kicking out to his team. Like, they missed a lot of shots off his passes, but he did enough. 16 points, 8 assists in this one. And then Banchero, man, a lot more physical. I thought did a good job of weaponizing his body, getting downhill. And his jumper was just falling. I mean, straight up, man. Like, Paolo was just hitting some of these nasty jumpers that he was missing. 13 of 26 in the field, 4 of 9 from deep. And he had missed some open threes, too. Playmaked well. This is just a great Paolo and Franz game. And then my boy Suggsy, man. Suggsy turned up in this game, dude.
Couldn't miss.
9 of 11 from the field, 3 of 5 from deep, 24 points. They needed it, man. The Magic guard rotation has been pretty abysmal. Cole Anthony, Markel Fultz struggling, Gary Harris. It's been ugly, dude. And they need one of these guards every game to step up. And today it was Suggs. And then on the inverse, I knew the Cavs Magic couldn't hold up forever, man. All their perimeter initiators go cold in this one. Mitchell, 13, 5, and 7, 6 of 16. Garland shoots 2 of 10 from the field. LeVert goes 5 of 13. Like, you just can't have that. These are your, you know, primary scorers. If they are not scoring or playmaking well, your offense is just grinding. Like, at a point in this game, Orlando was up 26. It was like 6, or my math's off, 36 maybe. It was like 64 to 100. They were getting dogged, man. It's like when those guys don't get going, this is what Cleveland is capable of. They are capable of having these duds. And that's why I picked the Magic in 7. Like, I expected more games with this version of Franz and Paolo, and I expected more games like this of Donovan and Garland. I've kind of flipped on that. I expect the inverse of that moving forward in the series, actually. But I did anticipate a few games like this where Cleveland goes cold and the Magic gets hot. That's what's so weird, man. I feel like more in this series than any other, shooting variance and then just who's feeling it from night to night really matters more. Cleveland goes cold from behind the arc, 8 of 34. Orlando doesn't. They shoot 13 of 37. Again, Paolo, Suggs, big parts of that. Yeah, man, Cleveland's got a very low floor, dude. When they are off, and when their perimeter guards are off, you know, Garland and Mitchell aren't getting easy looks and generating easy offense, this is the kind of floor that you can expect from Cleveland, man. I still think they're going to win out in this series. I think they've got the best player. I think they've got the second better, best perimeter initiator. But Mitchell and Garland are capable of having some clunkers, man. And this was one of those.
Garland's the second best perimeter creator
for in this series or for Cleveland?
In this series, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, who are you taking over him? Paolo? Franz?
Paolo. Garland looks bad, and Garland has just been so disappointing this year. I've been a Darius Garland guy forever. Like, obviously, he has the playmaking. He's still going to make good decisions, but Paolo's good enough as a playmaker to where just having to do with that sort of physical imposition, like when he taps into it, he does have a tendency to settle too much and rely on these tough jumpers. But Darius Garland, Logan, in this series is averaging 11 points and 6 assists per game on terrible efficiency. He's shooting 40% from 2, and that's always the concern with Garland. Like, he's a phenomenal shooter, but even though he's quick, he can struggle to finish around the rim. He's been relying on some tougher twos, which just is not good, like some off-balance mid-range looks in this one. He's been bad. They need him to be better because we can praise the Cavs bigs for being improved, and they are. They've been significantly better in this series than they were last year in basically every way. But like, you're still at an offensive skill deficit to most teams. The Magic are kind of an exception because I think they're the worst offense in the playoff field with those two guys out there. And then we know that they have solid wings, but they're basically just spot up shooters. So you kind of need both those guys to be good, or you need Mitchell to be great. And Mitchell has had really, really good moments. And through a game and a quarter, I was like, yeah, this guy's just so much better than everybody else on the floor. It doesn't matter. I still think he's clearly the best creator by a good margin. And I'm still confident in the Cavs winning the series. This game doesn't change that, but he just wasn't very good in this one. And when he wasn't, and Garland is awful, like, yikes, man, it's ugly. This Cavs offense is not good. I do think it's better than the Magic. I think they have more weapons. I think they have a more reliable star. I think they have more reliable creators, more reliable shot makers, bigger athletes to finish around the rim. They're still checking way more boxes, but goodness, this was ugly. Paolo was awesome, though. Paolo was awesome. And part of it was just like ridiculous shot making. We know that's not super reliable, right? He's like a 40% mid-range shooter. He loves his turnarounds, and he has moments where you're like, wow, how did you make that off balance? Part of it is he takes a lot of those shots, and eventually you're going to hit some of them. But this game, dude, it was just a clinic. It was awesome. Turnaround, step back, so one-legged fall away over Evan Mobley where he picked up his dribble and just clearly didn't have a plan, and he still scored. And he started this game cold. He came out 0-5, and then he was 2-11. And then from that point forward, he made 11 of his last 15 shots, was aggressive, just kept shooting. And I liked him taking that sort of mentality as obviously far and away the best player on the floor for Orlando, especially in this game. He was also willingly taking his spot up threes and hitting them, which is something that we talked about, him passing up on good looks there in game two, just because he's not the most comfortable spot up shooter. And then he did more physically imposing himself. You talked after game two about wanting him to do more of that switch hunting. There was one spot in this game where he forced Donovan Mitchell to switch onto him, like whoever the guard was screened for him. And then Paolo literally just held on and said, no, 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 you're sticking with me, pal. And then he went and he got a bucket on him. There was another spot where he legitimately bullied Evan Mobley, got to a short jumper. Orlando got him involved as a roller a couple times. He was super active on the offensive glass. He had 7 offensive boards, a lot of those off of his own misses. Like, it was just a much better version of Paolo than what we saw in the first two games. And that's awesome to see, in my opinion. Of course, he has a bunch of flaws. He's in his second year. He's inefficient as an offensive number one. His decision-making can be questionable. But seeing him have a game where he rises to this level and he's just like way better than everybody else on the floor was awesome. It's good for him to have a moment like that, even if the rest of this series is pretty ugly on all fronts, honestly. But Orlando was the team who could make a shot in this game from deep. Cleveland was the team who could not make a shot. Like, that is pretty much the standard. It's who can play passable offense, who is playing awful offense. And of course, both defenses are great as well. But Orlando also just out-executed them. They were better on the offensive glass. They took better care of the ball. I thought they defended better in this game. So it's a good win for them.
And they crushed them on the glass, period. Like, this was, you know.
Well, I mean, also because Cleveland missed 1,000 shots. But yeah, it's true. Having more offensive boards, considering how fewer shots they missed, that's impressive.
And just, I mean, this game was over by the third quarter. You know what I mean? Like, it was an unserious game by that point. Mm-hmm. They took all the starters out. It was, you know, 20 minutes of garbage time. So this is a beatdown, man. A good answer from a young Orlando team that, much like Philadelphia, man, I was wondering, like, is this the – are y'all going to throw in the towel? Is it time to throw it in? Like, are y'all done? And Orlando came with a lot of fight, a different game plan, a different mentality. I was very impressed. This is a very young team, man, and they answered the call today, dude. I don't feel differently about this series. I think Cleveland's a better team, but can I see this formula happening again, you know, where Cleveland shoots horribly, Donovan's off, and the Magic get another game? Definitely.
Yeah, I could see it too. It's going to be really rough sledding offensively for both teams, but this was an alarming Mitchell and Garland game. They need both those guys to be better. Mitchell was facilitating well early in this game, I thought, at least. Like, he was penetrating, and then he was making those dump-off passes, but just his shot-making wasn't there. It's really Garland where I'm like, hey, buddy, you got to get going here at some point, especially if you want to make Boston even remotely have to work, because you're not getting the Magic offense on the other side of this. All right, let's talk about the Celtics, Logan, because I shouldn't presume that it's going to be them. You know what happens when you assume, Logan? You know what happens? You make an ass out of you and me, pal. And that's what I did. On the last show that we talked about Celtics Heat, I said, Heat fans, if this series becomes even remotely interesting, you guys can do what you want with me. Sounds a bit strange, but I said, you guys can send me to the gallows, draw and quarter me. And sure enough, the Heat took game two, of course, without Jimmy Butler. How did that happen? And what did you take away from it?
The Boston Celtics, you know, just took the night off. I'm so disappointed, dude. Like I'm borderline angry with the Boston Celtics. They allowed Miami to break their franchise record of three-pointers made in a playoff game. They said it. Fun fact, in 2021 against the Bucks, they made 20 in that game. They go 23 of 43 in this game. And so you go, well, you know, how does that happen? Well, I'll give props. Tyler Hero did a phenomenal job in this game.
Yeah,
of
man.
Getting downhill, of collapsing the defense, of generating open looks. And you could tell. I know the players talked about it after the game in the interviews and stuff. Like, it was a conscious effort, you could tell, by Miami. And that is their recipe when they're at their best. We're going to take as many threes as possible. And if we're on, it's going to create a huge margin. It's just going to give us an advantage. It's an efficient shot. And there were a lot of open threes in this one. So Hero goes for 24 points, 14 assists, knocks down 6 three-pointers. Caleb Martin, the Celtic killer, bangs 5 of them. Nikola Jovic gives them great minutes, bangs 3 three-pointers. Bam did a great job defensively. And, you know, as a finisher, did some stuff on the low block too. 21, 10, and 2 on 9 of 13 shooting. Shout out to Jaime Jaquez. Shout out to Miami Heat for doing their thing. But moreover than anything else, I am just fed up with the Boston Celtics doing this, man. Carson, this was a statement game for me for Boston, man. No Jimmy Butler. Everybody else is taking care of business across the playoff landscape. Like, this is a big moment. This is a big game for Boston. I mean, you can put your foot on Miami's neck. No Jimmy Butler. We're going to beat the brakes off you guys. We're going to beat y'all senseless. They should have whooped them. And it is consistently, man, in these big games, it's another sad and embarrassing loss. Like, they let Miami off the hook, man. It is so frustrating that this Celtics team can be so dominant. And then this game, man, they just don't play defense. They are disengaged. There's bad rotations. There's no discipline. There's no energy or effort. There's no structure, and there's no game plan. The first guy I'm going to point the finger at is Kristaps Porzingis, where there were so many times in this game. Kristaps, you're a 7'3", dude, right? I don't know how long your wingspan is. I presume it's really long, 7'3" plus. Pretty big, man. After the Celtics hit, you know, after Miami hits 2 or 3 threes in my face, I think I'd put a hand up. There were so many instances, Carson, in this game where KP is on the perimeter and is just standing there, letting guys shoot over the top of him. Hand down, man down, man. There are too many possessions like that. And then offensively in this game, he gives me 6 points, 8 boards, 4 assists on 1 of 9 shooting and 0 of 4 from deep.
Yeah.
Abysmal. So he's the first guy I'm going to point to. And then the second guy is Joe Mazzulla. When the Celtics are reeling, Carson, it's weird. It's that Shane Falco, man. I talked about it last year in the playoffs. It's at quicksand, except the Celtics don't fight back. You know, the theory of quicksand is it's like you start scratching and crawling and you go deeper into the hole. The Celtics are just like, man, I'm just going to sink today. We're just not going to turn it around. That's one thing that is still so concerning to me about the Boston Celtics is when they are out of rhythm and they come out of the gate slow and they're not playing well, they can't turn it around. It is like a sinking ship that is not coming back up. And Boston has shown us this side of themselves so many times. It's just really concerning. They are so talented, but it is alarming to me that they can be so undisciplined some games. No game plan, no structure. It's like they were just thoughtless, brainless. They were just out there. And I'm frankly disgusted, Carson. Miami came into this game with an intent, with a game plan, and they were attacking and they were dictating. They came out with a ideology, with a process, and they executed. And Boston came out brainless, brain dead, with no game plan. And they just left me so underwhelmed, man. I'm so disappointed in Boston. I can't imagine how their fans feel.
The single worst thing you can do to the Miami Heat offense in general, but especially when they're down Jimmy Butler, is concede a bunch of open threes. And there are a bunch of reasons that the Celtics allowed that to happen. And of course, Miami shot making was crazy, right? Even if you're getting good looks from deep, which they were, you got to make 23 of 43. Like, that's crazy. They somehow just find that way, man. These individual games, these series, they shoot the lights out from deep. All the power to them. That's heat magic, man.
That's the point. They're capable of this, and you're not even making them work for those shots.
Well, and it's not just that they're capable of it, Logan. It's that they don't have the sort of athletes, they don't have the sort of on-ball creators who really threaten you downhill. And so I thought there was a lot of over-helping in this game where Boston basically had a drive contained and it would be against a sort of meh athlete and somebody would sink in too far and it would lead to an easy kick out three. Also, I thought some of their pick-and-roll coverages in this game were just like really problematic. Hero was fantastic. Hero has obviously had bigger scoring performances. This might be my favorite Tyler Hero game ever because I don't think I've ever seen him dissect a defense methodically like he did in this game. But Logan, like, there's certain spots where they're running these guard-on-guard screens. I think of one instance where there was just a flat-out defensive miscommunication. They didn't know if they were switching, and they got a wide-open three out of that. But then they're playing drop with Horford and then with Porzingis against Haywood Highsmith, Nikola Jovic. And I get that, like, you don't really love KB defending in space. Horford, I mean, he's not great there, but he's okay. But it's like you're conceding pick and pop threes by design to these good three-point shooters who aren't particularly, like, athletic, obviously, right? They're not threatening you downhill as rollers. So I just thought it was so bad. The effort was bad. Jaylen Brown, I had so many moments in this game where I'm just like, dude, get a hand up, rotate more quickly, have some more purpose defensively. And just overall, like, I would live with anything that the Heat offense could generate over open catch and shoot threes. I would absolutely live with just, right, I would live with dealing with a 2-on-1 out of pick and roll. I would certainly just play it straight up 2-on-2 and see if I can get a hero floater that I would consistently be sinking my defense in too far. And so you're creating those really good looks. I thought there was a lot of poor screen navigation from Boston this game, just getting caught up on those actions. It was bad. Like, that's the one way the Heat are going to beat you. They're going to rain threes on you. At the same time, I was impressed by Miami in this game. Tyler Hero giving you 24 and 14 on 81% true shooting, like, just consistently creating great looks out of pick and roll, making the right read basically every time, hitting poppers, running that pick and roll with Bam, hitting him over the top through a nice lob in this game. They trapped Hero a couple times. He created open threes out of that. And, just continually, he was making the extra pass, right? Pump fake, defender goes flying by, boom, I'm swinging to the open shooter. And the entire Miami Heat team did that because that's what they do. They're well-coached. They make good decisions. They have a game plan. And just by moving the ball, forcing the Celtics to constantly be in rotation and exposing their tendency to overhelp and whatnot, like, they just got open three after open three after open three.
And that's what I just didn't understand with Boston's defensive process in this game. One, I am making it an effort to just run them off the line. Like, at a point, please go shoot a mid-range jumper, get downhill, go get your layup. You're not going to hit any more threes on me. Like, I'm done. Mm-hmm. We're sealing off the perimeter. And then two, like you said, dude, you hit the nail on the head. Miami doesn't have anyone who's actually dangerous at pressuring. Why are you doubling off Tyler Hero in the mid-range? That's the shot we want. We want him to take a tough mid-range jumper. I'm just, if I was the Celtics head coach, I would be so frustrated. I don't know what Joe Mazzulla does coming into these games, man. I don't know what
he watches the town about four times a week. That's how he gets ready.
And he talks about building sandcastles, man. I'm so beyond frustrated with Boston and the fact that they have these duds. Great teams, championship teams don't have these kind of duds. There's no Jimmy Butler, man. There's no world in which you should lose this basketball game, man. This is a statement win, and it was a statement for Miami, man. I'm perpetually disappointed in Boston. I'm not going to count out Miami. I guess Miami has proven what they can do, but, like, dude, just there's such a talent discrepancy here. This should not be a series, man. Miami should not be competing, and yet they do this, man. I'm disappointed in Boston, dude. So disappointed.
This is definitely an issue that Boston could have addressed with a better defensive game plan, a better defensive communication, and better defensive effort, etc. But Hero was awesome. Bam balled out. We got like the best version of offensive Bam in this game. He was going at KP and Horford out of the post. He was nailing his turnarounds. He was great finishing out of pick and roll with Hero around the rim or pop into the free throw line area. He ran inverted pick and roll at one point that created a wide open three. Like, Bam was doing his thing. Nikola Jovic had a really nice game. Good playmaking. Was able to penetrate the defense some and create looks for others and also knock down his jumpers. Caleb Martin did what he does against the Boston Celtics, and he did not miss. Like, shout out to all these guys for stepping up, but you just can't let the Heat without Jimmy give you a 117 offensive rating, and you can't concede that many threes. Offensively, this wasn't a good Boston game. KP was awful, awful, could not hit a three, was incapable of attacking mismatches in this game, which he was the most efficient post-up player in basketball this year. That is what he did better than anybody, drawing fouls consistently, getting physical out of the post, and then shooting over guys easily. This is a small-ass Miami team. He should be able to do that with ease. And yet on post-ups, he was 0 of 3. He had one assist. He had one turnover. He just has to be able to bully these guys, and they bothered him some off the catch. They were able to get a hand on balls and whatnot. Drew really wasn't great. And, you know, Jaylen had his stretch of this game where he was really balling. Tatum had his stretch, but I don't put this on those guys offensively. The supporting cast just wasn't as good, and neither of those guys were exceptional enough. So the Celtics are going to be fine in this series, man. Even if Jimmy comes back, like, they 1,000% should be fine, but you just can't let this keep happening. You cannot have your brand be extremely talented team that is inevitably going to have some inexplicable lapses in decision-making and focus and effort and process. This happens every year. Like, every year we look at this series and we say, yeah, Boston should roll them. Obviously it's different without Jimmy, but what happens? They go seven and then they lose in seven. And even when they lose in seven, you feel like, oh wow, the Celtics finally locked in now that they're down 3-0. And it turns out that they're actually capable of kind of just steamrolling Miami when everything's going. And yet too consistently, it's, oh man, they can't figure out the zone. They're getting baited into bad three after bad three. And oh man, the decision-making is breaking down from Tatum and Brown. And oh man, this team full of defensive studs, otherworldly defensive personnel, are just playing stupid and playing low effort in a playoff game. That's my frustration with Boston. It's not that they're going to lose this series. It's, you guys got to win a title, man. One of these next 2 years, you got to win the title because you are crazy talented. I said I thought they weren't going to lose more than three games in the East this year. That's strike one. Strike one goes to a Miami team down Jimmy Butler. It's just the same thing, and it's frustrating. I don't think it's going to be their Achilles heel in the East this year because the East is so weak and they are so unbelievably stacked. But you just have to clean that up, man. It's time for the playoffs. Like, the margin is going to get slimmer and slimmer and slimmer until you're playing the Denver Nuggets, and then your margin is zero, and they're never going to have a game like this. The games that they start slow against the Lakers team that is way better than the Heat without Jimmy Butler, they still grind out. They still win. And unfortunately, you have a track record of not doing the same and of having way uglier lapses.
Well said. You hit on it. I ain't got nothing to add. That was it. Awesome. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to this next game. Thunder Pel.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now, you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Falcons, last one we're going to touch on. Very, very different from game one. Game one was a rock fight, came down to SGA hitting that go-ahead runner with under 30 seconds on the clock. This one was just an absolute blowout for OKC. What did you take away here?
I'm just so impressed with all the young guys in Oklahoma City, man. The big three, so to speak, SGA, J-Dub, and then Chet Holmgren, all three of those guys. It feels, Carson, unfair at times that all three of these guys gets to play together. Like, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is one of the handful of best players on planet Earth. He is unstoppable as a scorer. 33 points, 5 assists in this one on 13 of 19 from the field and 3 of 5 from deep. And it's like just a spoil of riches here in Oklahoma City, man. The fact that some possessions, Jalen Williams will get downhill, slam on the brakes, and hit a midi. And I squint and I go, damn, man, was that SGA getting the bucket?
And he's got a lot of SGA to him.
It's unfair. Like, we got two SGAs now. Like, that's how J-Dub plays. Their games are so similar. And the fact that that archetype and how these guys get buckets, big wings who can play physically and use their body to their advantage and get downhill, you know, great touch, but can also just slam on the brakes at will and hit a mid-range jumper in your face. It is going to lead to consistent, easy offense. And then your tertiary guy, your third creator, maybe your second, I don't know where you consider Chet. I mean, because Chet is so skilled, can run inverted pick and roll, can do all these things. And you got this guy space on the floor at a 40% clip, banging three threes in this game, cutting off ball, doing his thing, being in the right spot. It's unfair. And especially specifically in a matchup like this against New Orleans, it is such a good counter because, you know, these teams play such different brands of basketball. New Orleans is a grind you out, defensive, big body, you know, nasty kind of, we're going to muck it up. And Oklahoma City is this elegant, this regal kind of, we're just going to play offensively beautiful basketball. And that's the thing about Oklahoma City is you look and you go, man, they're not really physically overwhelming. They don't have these guys who are, you know, crazy, crazy athletes. They're not really stout and strong physically, but everybody on their roster can shoot. Everybody on their roster can put the ball on the floor. Everybody on their roster can attack a closeout. And all of these guys play so well together defensively and connected. It just works. But offensively, man, I know you've said this all year long, Carson, it really does feel like offensive heaven. And the one unstoppable action that consistently happens in Oklahoma City games is like a fake backdoor cut. It's so deadly, man, when somebody will drift into the paint and then they immediately go back out and they catch the rock. If that defender's caught napping, just everybody is so skilled in Oklahoma City. And the fact that they have three really young guys that are this skilled offensively, it's going to be hard to keep up with them when they're clicking on all cylinders like this offensively, man. This is a special, special offensive trio, man, and they put it on full display in this one.
And they're going to just get better and better and better, man. That's what I think about OKC. Some people think they can win the West this year. I personally think Denver is a buzzsaw, and I think that that's just an overwhelming physical matchup for them. But first of all, their window is going to be open for a long time. And when you talk about physicality, boy, did New Orleans test them early in this one. Willie Green said, get Jonas Valanciunas the ball. That man scored their first 11 points. And I believe at least one of those, I can't remember if there was more, was off of a post-up going at Chet, but a lot of it was just catching the ball on the interior, finishing over smaller defenders, attacking the offensive glass. And so he came out giving them problems as he had in game one when he racked up 20 boards. And then I thought from that point forward, Chet did a really nice job of matching up there. Overall, there were still a couple spots later in the game where it's like Valanciunas is just able to bully him physically, right? And he gets such good position and his touch is good and he's able to score one-on-one. But I believe there were six instances in which Valanciunas went at him out of the post. He scored on three and Chet kept him from scoring on three. And that, to me, is a win for OKC, especially when you consider the fact that Valanciunas didn't dominate on the glass in this one. And Chet was very active there, kept him off, was fighting for those 50-50 balls with his length. Because if you are saying, all right, well, when Valanciunas goes at him out of the post, like, yeah, sometimes he bullies him, but then sometimes Chet is just so long, his timing is so great. Like, he got bumped on one of those possessions, but his length is so crazy, he meets him at the top of his release and he still blocks him. He got a hand on a couple entry passes. Like, he just made him work really hard. And then if Chet's able to battle on the glass, then Chet is doing everything else at such a higher level, right? He's spacing the floor. He's presenting massive problems for Valanciunas defensively in space. He's bringing more in terms of playmaking, ball handling, transition, all these things. Like, if he can just hold up enough physically, then tough luck, Jonas. Like, you're damn near getting played off the floor. And just considering how strong he started that game, I thought it was really encouraging that OKC and specifically Chet was able to hold up well against him down the stretch, because offensively Chet exploded. He had 20 in the first half. Pick and pop was lethal. Closeout attacking was phenomenal. So good ball handling, so quick for his size. Mid-range shot making, had a couple big moments there. Had one spot where he bumped B.I. and B.I. fell to the ground. And instead of taking the mid-range jumper that he had available, or more of like a short jumper, 10 feet or whatever, he stepped through and he just dunked that ball. It was an awesome Chet game. This dude is one of the special rookies in NBA history. And I've said this, but if he weren't going up against Wemby, like, you drop him in a vast majority of rookie classes this century, with the exception of just a few, he's winning rookie of the year. This sort of winning impact, this sort of refined skill set, elite rim protector, elite floor spacing big, elite running the floor in transition, quick, super comfortable handling, good playmaker, really good rim finisher, which he showed in this game too. Massive target there, even though he's very slight, embraces the physicality of the game. Like, he's not afraid of it. What a monster. I think he's an MVP caliber player down the line. I think he epitomizes everything you want from a modern big. And I think he's for sure a top 10 player. And along with SGA, who's already at that top five level, just like, good luck, league, and J-Dub, who I think is going to be all NBA. This was a great SGA game, though. And this shows you exactly why SGA is built for this playoff moment, why I've been such an SGA believer in terms of how he translates to the playoffs. He gets downhill in a few spots here. He's so hard to stay in front of, but he just murdered them with that difficult shot making, that short mid-range shot making, the ability to stop on a dime, to step back and just hit those jumpers over you with a like damn near 55% clip. That translates. If you can dominate from those spots, you will always be able to get there in these playoff environments. And he did that against really stellar perimeter defense. So he was phenomenal. 33 on 13 of 19 shooting. He's just one of those dudes. And by the way, J-Dub was really good offensively. He was also awesome defensively. And that's where we have to give OKC props. You talk about how they play this elegant, graceful game offensively. True. But defensively, they grind. They are going to make you work. They have dudes who are able to double and help and recover quickly. They have athletes all over the floor. J-Dub and Lou, like, both those guys have been awesome. And they've made life really hard on the Pelicans, who ultimately, without Zion out there, just don't have enough firepower to win this series, even though they do present some physical challenges. Zion would be a real physical challenge. That'd be interesting. Unfortunately, don't think we're going to get to see that. But this was a really good win for OKC. Game one was a good win in the sense that, all right, you've been tested in that tough playoff environment. Let's see if you can grind out a tough one. This one was, all right, well, you're just so damn good that you're going to pull away from a team like this. And both of those are encouraging in their own ways.
Very. I do feel a little robbed in this series that we didn't get to see Zion. But
yeah,
and the Pelicans are just kind of a little outmatched here. You know, Brandon Ingram, I don't think is at 100%. Can't really exert what he needs to on the game. And then McCollum is your lead offensive guy. It's just a tough draw against an Oklahoma City team that I think is, you know, just so much better offensively. And then a team that with effort and energy can outplay you. And the Pelicans offense just grinds to a standstill too much, man. It's a bad matchup for a team like this. And that was an issue that the Pelicans offense had even when Zion was healthy. You know, I mean, they could have these stretches where they just don't score and don't get the lid off the basket for long periods of time. And that's kind of a death knell against this Oklahoma City team, man. So one advantage that I give the Thunder over a lot of other teams who may be skeptical about their prospects this year, that offense doesn't ever really stop, man. That's the SGA, J-Dub, Chet combo, man. And I think they are. I think they're destined to really make some noise in a few years. I think this is a championship core, dude. The Thunder, so great.
Josh Giddey, not looking so good. Better in this one than game one. Knocks down an open spot up three in garbage time, which is probably good for morale. It boosted the numbers a little bit in garbage time overall, but I still do think we're going to need to see more Kayson Wallace than him when it matters, or even Isaiah Joe, or even Aaron Wiggins. I think Kayson is the best of the bunch, but I'm still worried about Giddey. But Lou nailing his jumpers in this one. I mean, he's been so improved there this year. Like, goodness, dude. OKC. It was a phenomenal offensive performance. They shot 59% from the field. That's what they do when they're clicking, and it is fun to watch.
Dude, that's what's so cool about Oklahoma City's recipe, too. I don't know if I mentioned this last time we were talking about the Thunder, but the fact that they have these guys, and then they have, you know, offensively, and then they have Lou Dort, who can just take on anybody's best perimeter initiator, and then you got Chet on the inside, who is just a generational kind of rim protector. It's... they work so well together. And now that Lou is hitting, you know, his threes at a 40% clip off the catch, he's an elite role player to have with this group.
I mean, bro, when you have Kayson out there instead of Giddey or Isaiah Joe or Aaron Wiggins, any of these guys, like, that is the truest five out in terms of everybody is a damn good three-point shooter that I can think of. It's different from the small ball Warriors death lineup. Like, that is, everybody is a damn good shooter. OKC, man, they are the future. And to some extent, they are the present. All right, Logan, we did it. We covered all five games. Sorry that we missed a day, guys, but we won't be missing many. We're going to keep on coming throughout this first round that has been so much fun. Final thoughts. Should Darvin Ham be fired?
Naz Reid.
That's your answer? All right, I guess we'll save that one for once the Lakers are officially eliminated. I like that, Logan. That's actually called edging. And so that's something that we are big fans and proponents of here at Nerd Sesh. Appreciate you guys, as always. Hope you enjoyed. If you did, we are going to keep on coming with this content, baby, doing shows almost every night here in the playoffs, going live. But of course, you can watch them after on YouTube, or you can listen to them across audio platforms. Also on YouTube, I made a video today about Pascal Siakam. How is he leading the playoffs in scoring? Pascal Siakam, of all people, you may be wondering. Watch that video to find out. If you don't, I will be sad, because they're fun to make, and I hope you guys like them, and we're going to keep doing more of those as well. So stay tuned in for all that. Follow us across social, TikTok and Instagram at NerdSesh, Twitter at Nerd_Sesh to see all of our trivia content and some clips from the show. Buy that hat right off of Logan's noggin at thevolume.com, along with all of our other merch. And you can join our Discord to talk NBA, to talk NFL, whatever you want, man. That is at the link that is in our link tree, which is across all of our social media bios. So with that, as always, Naz Reid, as Logan said, appreciate you guys. I've been Carson Brabber.
I have been Logan Camden.
What a way to go out. And this was Nerd Sesh.
Getting ready to take on spring? Make your first move with the reliable performance and power of Steel battery tools. From hedge trimmers and mowers to string trimmers and more, right now you can save $50 on select battery tool sets. Real Steel. Offer valid on select AK system sets through June 16, 2024. See participating retailer for details.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home, where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. and you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.